Hello, everybody. Let's have an AA meeting. My name is Kat, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speaker Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describe in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, hear a speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them, too, I must have this thing. The speaker tonight is Mike V. I don't know him. I do know that he's from the Vinings group, so look forward to hearing your story.
Thanks, guys.
My name's Mike. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm very grateful to be here tonight. You know, I always start out my story by saying that couple things. First, this isn't a story of victimhood. This is a story of surviving and how the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life. And another thing I always say is if I get melodramatic, I'm not trying to be. I'm really trying to really hit hard how no matter how far down the scale you have gone, no matter how bad it gets, no matter how dark it gets, if you're willing, you can recover. Because I did. My sobriety date is September 29, 2010. I did not come in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous willingly. It was court ordered to be here. And that's decision to seek treatment instead of jail, 31 years of hell had led up to that court date. I was born in Atlanta. My mom was a drug addict, and she was Irish, and that is all that I know about my mom. My dad, I have no clue. When my mom was 17, she had another child, my half sister, by another guy, and she gave us both up to the foster care system. Reached the point where she couldn't take care of us. Maybe that we were taken away. I don't know. A lot of those facts, I really don't know. And that's just how it is. Well, I became custody of the state at 2. And like I said, we bounced around from foster care family, for a while. And then a few years later, ended up with this couple on the north side of Atlanta. He was in his late 40s, and she was in her early 20s, unable to have kids. I really feel like she kind of convinced him to have kids and kind of get into this foster care thing. I was later on able to reestablish a relationship with her because the adoption and the foster care system did not go very well. You know, when somebody gets in that position, when a child gets in that position and they get adopted, now there's two ways they can go. They can get adopted from a great family and they can save them, and it's the greatest thing that ever happened. This kid has a chance. Or it could go my way, the other way. He was violent, and he was angry, and I was you know, later on, I was, like I said, I was able to reestablish a relationship with her, and I asked her, if you guys couldn't take care of kids, why would you have kids? And she gave me the answer that I already knew and that I didn't really want, which was, well, we were a lower middle class, and it was a good way to make money. Okay, that explains a lot, because he was violent right at the start. I really think he regretted the entire thing. He had already had a couple of kids. They were grown. I'm telling you all this because it really kind of cemented, you know, how I was going to be for the next couple of decades of my life. The beating started very early. There was lots of abuse. There was physical abuse. There was psychological abuse, emotional abuse. I was told that this was all happening because I deserved it, and this was all happening. You know, my mom didn't even, you know, your parents didn't even want you, you know, so this is the best you can get. So, you know, you better be grateful for that. And that really... Those messages kind of stuck in my brain for the rest of my life, you know. Well, up until I got sober, at least. And is this battery going to die on me? So yeah, it was torturous. It was hellish, and it was a lot of frightened nights and a lot of locked in my room. And you know, I'm not going to get into the gory graphic details. I mean, I'm sure any documentaries, you'd be able to look it up. When I was 12 years old, I decided that it was time for that to end. And I tried to hang myself. I was found by one of my foster brothers, and he cut me down. And that's when they came home and, you know, gave me a severe beating for, you know, causing so much trouble. And that's when they told me, you know, I should be grateful, because that's when they told me the truth. They ended up adopting us because the state was going to take us away and kind of separate us. And, you know, it's kind of like, I mean, not to put judgment or, you know, speculation, but it's kind of like when you got a puppy, you don't know how to take care of it, you know, but like that's yours, and you can't take this away, so adoption was a way to kind of finagle the system. And so a couple years after that, they ended up separating, and I stayed with him because I wanted to be in Atlanta, and that's when it got really bad, because it was nothing but me and him until I got kicked out of school, and he beat the shit out of me and kicked me out of the house. So I went to go live with her down in South Georgia. I was about, you know, 14, 15 at this time. So at that time, I got sent to a new school, a school that I didn't know, very small town, very isolated. Now, the cool thing is that the beatings at home stopped. Now the beatings were starting at school. And I didn't fit in. I just wasn't good at making friends, and I never felt like I belonged there, and I felt like there was something wrong with me. And by my teen years, that darkness kind of set in, because I always tell people there's a certain line where you know, love me becomes fuck you, and it's easier to fight than it is to cry, and I had reached that point. I have a therapist friend who tells me that you know, if you ever want to see pure evil, look in the eyes of an abused child. And at that point, I was. That had set in. That was who I was. And I hated everybody, and I hated everything. And I lashed out, and they threw everything at me that they could. You know, boot camps, jails, mental hospitals. When I was 16 years old, that's when I had my second my second suicide attempt. I slashed my wrist and didn't die from that one either. But something magical happened when I was 14 years old. I started working in this restaurant, washing dishes, and they taught me how to cook, and they taught me, it was a little mom and pop place, and I pretty much had to run at the place at night, and they had a large supply of alcohol, and I never had alcohol. I think one of my earlier foster brothers, I think as a trick, they gave me a glass of 7-Up. They said it was 7-Up. It wasn't 7-Up, it was vodka. Made me throw up, but that was my first drink, but even then, I can go back and remember, like, that night, you know, that broom handle felt a little different. And maybe that planted the seed in me I was later on to find out that was my ticket. So when I was 14 years old, that's when I started to drink. And I also discovered something else to relieve my pain, too, and that was to cut. So that's what it was for me. It was cutting and it was drinking. And I would go to high school and I would take two things that I needed. I took a bottle of vodka or whiskey with me every day and a knife. And when the pain got too rough, I would go in the bathroom and I would cut on myself. And the scars are up and down my arms. Some are covered by tattoos, but I don't really want them covered up because they're a part of me and they're a part of my story. And they got me in this room, and I'm not regretting them. So that's how I went through high school, basically. Just numb. And you did not want to be around me. And when I was 16 years old, I remember sitting in my classroom, looking at all the other kids that, in my mind, had what I didn't have, and hating everybody in there. That what the world had done to me. It was all very, you know, this is what had happened to me, and fuck all of you. And I plotted and I planned it out. I was going to murder them. So something told me to drop the hell out of high school. So I did. Got out of high school. 2 years later, Columbine happened. It's funny. I mean, you never really hear somebody say dropping out of high school is the best decision of their life, but I think it was. So, you know, got a second job, a third job, living in ratty basement apartments, living on the street, just anything I could do to survive. And, you know, it was just work, and it was just booze, and it was no friends. And then I was 18 years old. Another, you know, two odd things happened to me. Crazy things happened. One, I stumbled upon a career. I've been in logistics for the last 16 years, and I walked into this warehouse, and I was like, what do you do? And they were like, well, do you know how to drive a forklift? No. We'll teach you. Okay. You know, what? I was working night shift at this grocery store, and it was, and my boss was this former U.S. Marshal, Sam Elliott type, man. And he pulled me aside one day, and he said, kid, let me tell you something. For a high school dropout, if you ever want to learn how to make money, if you want to make good money with no education, learn to drive heavy equipment and learn to drive a forklift. 2 years later, I was driving a forklift. All right, thanks. It was making $11 an hour, so I don't have to make $5.15 working two jobs anymore. That's more money than I'd ever seen. I thought I was doing great. Another thing happened that year is one of the few parties that I ended up at, I fell in love. I met this girl and we started talking, and we didn't stop talking until the very next morning. And I fell hard, which was the worst thing that could happen to a guy like me, because I didn't know how to love. I did not know how to love. First time she ever told me she loved me, I broke up with her. Because everyone who ever said they loved me left. So, for 6 years of our relationship, I had put everything on the her that had been put onto me. I was no longer a victim. I was no longer being abused. I was the abuser. I had control. And it was all her fault. And I did some really horrible things to that person, and I treated that person very, very badly. I treated everybody very, very badly. And the closer you ever got to me was the worst that it got for you. At 24, I had my third suicide attempt. This time was pills and vodka. I was staying at this guy that I knew from work. I was staying on his couch. They went out for 2 days, and I was just trying to kill myself. And I woke up 2 days later, and I was like, I didn't know if I was alive or dead. I don't know what death is like, but apparently I was alive. So at 25, this is the 11-year anniversary. At 25, 2 weeks before my 25th birthday, she left. She finally had the courage to leave. I got home and the apartment was empty. And I formulated a plan right then and there about how I was going to get through life. How am I going to get through life? This is all that I had. You know, this girl and this alcohol is all I had. I was like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go to work, and I'm going to cut in the bathroom at work and when I'm needed to, and I was going to, you know, drink before work, drink during lunch, and when I got off of work, I'm just going to stay obliterated until I passed out. That's how it worked. And that's how I planned on living my life, and that's how I did live my life. You know, people would come here and there, and I'd chase them off. There'd be violent fights. There'd be bar brawls. I was not a very nice person. And I did a very lot of bad things. But, you know, everything that ever happened was just another reason, you know. I was no longer, you know, my reason for drinking then was because she left me. Well, I was in love and she left me. How dare she? So when I was 26, that's when I got my first DUI. Now, a lot of people, I will tell you that my first DUI was not an accident. It was not me going to a bar and having a few drinks, one too many. Hey, I'm all right, I can drive. No, it wasn't like that. It was a rainy night. I was sitting in a bar. And I was looking at all the happy people. And I was looking at all the people that I had, but I didn't. And I hated them all. And picture after picture after picture, shot after shot after shot, the anger grew and grew and grew. I got in my car, I turned the lights off, and I drove up and down 75 at 85 miles an hour looking to kill somebody. I got pulled over. I don't know why I pulled over, and so I got my first DUI. The cop didn't pick on what I was trying to do. He just saw this kid, you know, over the limit and took him to jail. Well, my first DUI was a little slap on the wrist, you know. Did the probation, did all that, and went back to my life. Continued hurting people. Continued losing jobs. You know, there'd be a certain point where, like, my life would get good, you know. I'd be out of place for, like, 3 or 4 years. And then I would do something dumb. I'd, you know, show up drunk or, you know, punch out a coworker or, you know, yell at a truck driver or something. I'd end up losing my job. And I never really held a job more than maybe 4 or 5 years. It's funny. It's like the people I work with, they liked the work I did. They just knew not to be around me. And after a while, that caught up with me. You know, you can't go into work every day drunk. You just can't. I was driving a 2-ton forklift, guys. Come on. But, I got kicked out of my, I got evicted and ended up living on the street for a couple of months. Finally, got an apartment back in Atlanta with this girl that I met on the internet. We became fast friends, and she thought it was a great idea for us to live together. So I was like, hey, sure. That didn't go very well for her. Same situation. This one, it didn't take 6 years. She was out in a couple. And so in 2008, she ended up moving out. And because she was terrified of me. And so here I am. I'm stuck with this, you know, two-bedroom apartment with holes in the wall. And it was a place that I had trashed. And just, it was just a mess, you know. It was just a mess, but that's who I was. I was a sociopath. I was, and all I wanted to do was drink, and cut, and hate. Because For me, there was no other answer. There was nothing else. There was nothing else. The world was a dark place, and I was just waiting to die. And when I was 31. Second DUI. This time I wasn't trying to kill anybody, but I was way over the limit. And because all of my arrests were alcohol related, they kind of, you know, threw the book at me. It was like 90 days. And I was like, okay. Well, I've been in jail a bunch of times. I can do 90 days. It's not a big deal. But if I get evicted again, I'm not going to be able to get another place. I'm going to be back in the street. I don't want to lose my apartment. I mean, this is the mind of an alcoholic here, okay? Because it's like I have a shitty apartment that I cannot afford. I have a shitty job working overnight that I hate. But I have a great fucking life. And if you throw me in jail, I'm going to lose it. So I'll do anything you would need me to do. So they recommended a program. It was in Cherokee County, but they had one in Cobb where I live. So I ended up having it transferred. There's a program for multiple DUI offenders. And it's outpatient. It's therapy. It's group therapy, it's individual counseling, it's family group. I don't know how I was going to do that. You know, I guess we'll figure it out later. Drug testing. So I was like, okay, I'll do that. You know, I'll do that, and I know how to skate the courts. I know how to drink behind people's back, and I know how to pass drug tests. No problem. Well, I found out very quickly that, there was no passing drug test. And there was no, you know, when they told you that AA meetings, you better go to AA meetings or you're going to jail. So September 29th, I came home from work and I drank a 12-pack of Bud Ice, had 4 shots of Jack Daniels whiskey. I took a nap for 2-3 hours. I got in my friend's car and I drove up Cherokee County and I pled guilty. And I haven't drank since. That night, I went home and realized that I made a terrible, terrible mistake. I was like, I'm not going to make it. I'm not going to make it. I mean, these people, the courts, the counselors, all the other people that I had to go observing, they don't understand. They took the one thing that kills my pain. I'm not going to make it. I'll be dead in a week. So I was just kind of just going through the motions, man. I was going, you know, they took my license, I got a bike, and I just kind of just did, kind of just going through the motions. And I don't know why, man, but something happened. I was sitting in my therapist's office, and two things happened in my early in my early recovery, which I think turned the light on for me. One thing was I had a counselor who told me why I ran to alcohol the way that I did. It was a painkiller. Why I was dependent, why I abused it, why I needed it so much. Then I had a sponsor who explained to me what alcoholism was and that I could not stop. I didn't want anything to do with this AA thing. I didn't want to get sober. My plan was to do what they told me to do, go back to my great life. As a matter of fact, they told me to get a sponsor, right? My sponsor, first meeting I ever went to was a Sunday night meeting at Vining's. He was the first guy he talked to me. And he was a very, you know, just had the world by the balls and just happy and just, hey man, how's it going? Blah, blah, blah. What's up? What's the word, man? I talked to him for a little bit, told him, you know, pissed and moan about my little story, about what the courts did to me. And came time for them to, you know, raise your hand if you can be a sponsor. And he raised his hand. I was like, boom, that's it. I already taught to that guy. If I get him to be my sponsor, then I don't have to talk to these other freaking people. That was the plan. I've had a lot of plans, guys. And here I am up here. This was not part of the plan. But I was sitting in my therapist's office. And she had made the connection between what happens in childhood affects your adult life. Now, on paper, that makes a lot of sense, but to me, it didn't. But at that moment, it did. And that, to me, gave her enough credibility to me that I could listen to every word she said. So when she said, Mike, take out the earbuds and listen to the people around you. When you go to these AA meetings, don't just wait to get your seat. To get your sheet signed, listen to what they had to say. When my sponsor told me to read the first 164 pages, I was like, I got to read this? Are we going to read it together? I got to read it? She said, read it. So I read it. And when I sat down with my sponsor, we used to meet at Starbucks once a week. That was something that I had to do so that he could, you know, call into the courts, you know, for me. So I'm doing this guy a favor by sitting down with him. And he can do me a favor by calling in the courts so I don't go to jail. But when he sat there, I mean, and told me the last 6 months of his alcoholism was. And he talked about the depression and the pain. And the wanting to stop but can't stop, wanting to die but can't die. I mean, this guy, man, he came from a good family. He had everything in life that I did. But he felt the same way that I did. How the fuck is that possible? Once again, that gave him enough credibility that I could listen to what he said. You know, I remember sitting there and it was like, dude, you think I like living this way? There's no other way for me to live. And he's like, Mike, yeah, there is. So I was like, you show me. You show me then. All right. I had nowhere else to go. So I listened. And he showed me. And I knew it wasn't going to work. But I did it. And I did it because I had no place else to go. One day I wasn't willing, and one day I was. And in between that was desperation. And I wrote this after I picked up my 4-year medallion, and this pretty much describes, you know, why I chose on that day to listen. It says, at 4 years sober, I could not have imagined that an unwanted child from a terribly abusive home could end up here. I could never have dreamed that a path through mental institutions and multiple jail cells could lead me to a program of recovery. 3 suicide attempts, a lifetime of self-mutilation, and drinking myself to death left me no desire to get sober. I came into treatment due to legal consequences. I was born with the gift of desperation, and one day I became willing to walk where others had before me to find hope. Even as skeptical as I was, I found hope in the stories of others. I followed a simple program of action and found a spiritual experience that was my very own, a higher power that was personal to me and didn't belong to anyone else. Hate became love, self-pity became selflessness, apathy became service. I dedicated my life to helping others and saw that no matter how far down the scale I had gone, my experience could benefit others. I wore my heart on my sleeve and talk about survival so that one day my story can help others to find a way out of the hell that I came from. So that if you feel hopeless, and if you feel that you could not stop drinking, sincerely have a desire to, I want you to know that I am here. That's why I'm here tonight. That's why I'm here tonight. Because we all have a story to tell, and this one's mine. And I didn't believe in any of this. I didn't think it was going to work. But the guys before me showed me that there was another way to live. And it's just a simple program of action. One, you know, admitting that I'm paralyzed over alcoholism, my life had become unmanageable. Yeah. Long time ago. What I didn't understand was, what do you do about it? What do you do about it? You know, my hat's off to anybody that ever walks into one of these rooms and says, my name is so-and-so because I'm an alcoholic. I don't have that in me, guys. I do not have that in me. I don't understand desperation because, okay, you're desperate. I was desperate. You're desperate. There's no answer. You die. That's just simple, right? But you come in here, and the examples that are before you, and you follow them, and you don't think it's going to work, and you follow them because you don't want where you come from. You don't want it. It's a dark place. But you find the answers in the stories of others. And so that's what I did. But then they told me that it was a spiritual program. I'm like, what the hell are you talking about? Yeah, I'm an atheist. That's not going to work. You know, it's funny. It's like, my whole life, and even up to this point, you know, I don't really kind of buy into what anybody else says, you know, you know, I always think there's another way to think. You know, I've always been a punk, a rebel. You know, there's a different way to think. There's a different way to look at things. You know, but when it came to the God thing, I was like, oh yeah, I know what that is. People, you know, I heard what that's about. Yeah, I never really could think there was another way to think about it until I got here. You know, I always tell people, forget everything you ever thought you knew about life, and forget everything you ever thought you knew about God. Because this thing turns everything on its head. And it does. And so I followed the simple program. I did a moral inventory. You know, for 2 straight years, everything that I did in this program was out of sheer desperation and sheer not wanting to go back to where I came from. So to give you guys a little insight to that desperation, when it came down to my 4th step, I knew what was gonna come out. I knew what I had to talk about. I knew what I had to get to the root of, and I didn't want to do it. I was scared. God, I was scared. So, and if there's any newcomers here tonight, do not try this. Do not try this. But I was so skeptical that this thing was not going to work and then I was going to have to go back to drinking that I had a notepad, I had a pen, and I started writing my 4th step, and on the end of the table was a bottle of Jack Daniels. And I said, if this doesn't work, if I cannot do this, there's always that. That was my backup. I did it. I ended up not drinking. God was in that room tonight. I didn't even want him there, but he was there. I didn't drink. Poured the bottle out when I got done. So pissed. But I was like, okay. Okay, it works. And I didn't. And then my 5th step came, and I'm sitting in my apartment, and I'm telling this guy, another human being, things that I had never told anybody before. No one knows about this stuff except for the people that were there. And the other two people that were there, one person I don't talk to, and the other person I rarely talk to. And I told him. And he said, it's going to be all right. And when it came time to finding my part, I got pissed. I got pissed because he said, you got to find your part in all this. Dude, I was a fucking child. What is my part in this? Mike, you're still carrying it around. That happened a long time ago. You're still carrying it around. And I knew then that the only way to get past any of this was just I had to forgive and I had to let go. And I was like, I will do anything not to carry this around anymore. I will do anything not to wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning haunted by this shit. I will do anything not to hate people. I will do anything to get out of that selfishness that drove me to dislike people I never even met. And he showed me. And it's been a long road, and it's been a hard road. And when I was 2 years sober, I hit an emotional bottom. Because, see, what happened was, is I got sober, right? And the spiritual experience happened for me very quickly. And I kind of feel like it happened quickly because of I didn't have a whole lot of time. It's like as soon as I got out of treatment, it just shit wouldn't work and I was gone. But I continued to do it and it happened. So I was like, can you work with others? That's the solution for me. You know, I was 9 months sober and I was going batshit crazy and I was done. I actually cut myself that night and I was like, I cannot do this anymore. And I'm walking down South Cobb and I'm just going out of my mind and I'm like, I'm not going back to any meetings. I'm not doing this anymore because my life is not getting any better and this shit's not going away. Then I got a phone call. I decided at that moment I was either going to kill myself or I was going to get drunk. Then I got a phone call. And that phone call was a guy that I knew in the rooms in my home group who was there longer than I've been there was just coming out of detox. He went back out, went through detox, and he needed to reach out and talk to somebody. He needed help. And he calls me. Me. This horrible piece of shit who wanted to murder his classmates, he calls me. No one... Why? And then I realized right then, that's the answer. That's the solution. That's the answer for me. That's God on that phone, Mike. I can help others with this. And that's what I've been doing ever since. You know, so I just hit the ground running with sponsorship, and I was going to a lot of meetings, and I was just doing everything I needed to do, right? But, you know, I wasn't really feeling anything, though. I wasn't really facing what was really inside. So 2 years, I hit an emotional bottom. The only thing keeping me alive is my spiritual, was that spiritual entity that's deep inside of me. That was the only thing that was keeping me going. And one night I was in a meeting and I was like, you know what? There's something going on. I'm hearing these messages like, you know, you're a fraud. You know, you were born in the gutter. You're going to die in the gutter. I don't know what you're trying to do with the sobriety thing, but it's only a matter of time. It's only a matter of time before you self-destruct. And I listened to it. And I knew I needed to talk to somebody about it, but I was like, you know what? No. No, because they don't get it. You guys don't get it. You guys don't understand what's going on up here. And I didn't tell anybody. So I went home. And I wanted to kill myself. And guess what? I didn't go away. And then once again, when I didn't know what else to do. So I walked into a meeting and I said, my name's Mike. I'm 2 years sober. I have no solution. I have no hope. All I want to do is kill myself. I don't know why. Once again, this program came to my rescue. And there's people that are in my home group and they saved my life. They saved my life. And I came out of that stronger than ever. My story of sobriety and before sobriety is one of pain, and through that pain becomes faith and hope. And I've learned a lot of hard lessons in this program. I've learned, you know, that because all I want to do is save everybody, right? I mean, this is awesome, and I wanted to get everybody, but that's not how it works. I wasn't ready at 26. I was ready at 31. I can't tell you the difference. I don't know. Something just happened. So and happens for everybody for at different times. And I have people struggling in my life right now that I can't do anything for them. All I can do is sit here and say, if you want help, I'm here. And I want you to know that I am here. Because it works. It really does work. And that's what it's like, you know. And something else I wanted to read tonight. You know, yeah, sometimes I think about how far I've come and how, you know, and what got me here. And I don't know if anyone in my life will ever truly know just how bad it was. The abandonment and the beatings turned into 24 hours a day of self-harm, suicidal depression, and self-hate. Alcohol became my savior. There was no partying and the drinking to have a good time. There was only darkness. I drank to escape, and I drank to die. I never wanted to get sober. I never wanted survival. Sobriety found me. I truly believe that. Sobriety found me. God found me. I did not want to get sober. But through sobriety, it came a purpose. It came love, and it came peace. Do the ones I see today know that the kid who once planned to murder his classmates, who once tried to kill the woman he wanted to marry, became the guy who loves everyone so much that it hurts? That when they say nice things about him, that his heart melts because he finds it amazing that anyone could ever feel that way about him? Do they know that every scar fills him with gratitude because he knows he is so lucky to be alive? That he wants nothing more to become a beacon of hope in service to others? They say recovery is a second chance at life, but for me, I embrace it fully because I know I never even had a first one. I sometimes feel kind of alone because I still haven't heard my story, but I know that that's only because many who have been where I've been don't make it. But I will spend the rest of my life trying to repay the gift I have received from you guys. I thank everyone who has helped me along the way, and forgive the ones who caused all the pain. I'm here to let others know that every life is worth living, and you can survive any amount of pain and get to the beauty of life. No one ever has to die from this. I'm proof that if you need someone to talk to, and if you feel that you're hopeless or alone, I just want you to know that I'm here. So if you're in this room tonight, and if you have a sincere desire to quit, I want you to know that I'm here to help. Hope lives in this room. So, thanks for letting me share my story with you guys tonight.
Thank you very much. It was a great story. Stop the big debate.
try.